And do you know what the first thought that ran through my head was? Enthusiasm at number one, don't yuck someone's yum.
Yes.
You need to listen to Electric Enthusiasm. Calm down. Welcome to Electric Enthusiasm, the podcast where we celebrate unironic enthusiasm. I'm very busy today. No time to help you. Katie Cobalt.
And I got that reference.
Yes.
Yeah. And I'm Alexander Kjolf, and I am so grateful that I don't live in the parallel universe where we all have sausage fingers.
Hot dog fingers are not the way forward.
Man. Oh,
would
man.
You have mustard or ketchup coming out of them, though?
Remoulade?
Oh, Remoulade,
Remoulade, yes. Remoulade all the way. Chunky. For those who do not get the reference, by the end of this podcast, you will.
That's amazing. Alex, tell us how this works, because it's a new season. We're doing something special.
Yes, we are. Normally, in each episode, one of us presents a topic that they love, but that the other host knows little to nothing about. This time, I do know something about it, just a little bit. The goal is then to spread their enthusiasm to the other host and to you, the listener. In this case, that is enthusiasm has been well established. I love our topic for today, but I don't know a lot about it, so far, so good. Occasionally, we have guests on. We're super excited about something that we know nearly nothing about.
We also have the moment of meta, where we nerd out about enthusiasm itself and talk about why it matters and how you can live this fabulous enthusiastic life that we both live.
Because the world needs more enthusiasts. And you should share your enthusiasms with us on our website, electricenthusiasm.com, or our Instagram, @electricenthusiasm. Tell us what you're excited about these days. You could even plain old send us an email at hello@electricenthusiasm.com. What are we talking about?
We're talking about the film Everything, Everywhere, All at Once. So here is the caveat that we have to make at the beginning of this episode, which is, if you, my dear listener, have not seen this film yet, please turn off this podcast.
Yes,
do not
immediately.
Listen to this episode. Walk away. Run now.
Yeah. I feel like this is one movie that... it's just way better if you know essentially nothing. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've already told people the title. We've already spoiled that for them. If you could go into it knowing not even that, that would be ideal. Don't watch any trailers. Don't read any reviews. Just go in knowing nothing.
Yes.
And that's essentially what I did. You were in Copenhagen and you took us to see it and it was spectacular. I had not seen the trailer. I had not read anything about it. It was such a great way to see the movie. In fact, can I share a little something I do?
Yeah, go for it.
If I'm in the cinema and they're showing trailers for upcoming movies and I know I'm going to see that movie, I actually close my eyes and I plug my ears. I'm serious. I want to go into movies knowing as little as I can about them.
Yeah.
And also trailers these days tend to give away the whole fucking movie.
Yeah, very much.
A lot of the set pieces are already spoiled in the trailer. I try to avoid that. If I know I'm going to watch the movie, I close my eyes. So I had not seen the trailers for Everything Everywhere All at Once and I'm so glad I hadn't.
No,
so good.
I basically forced you into watching it, I feel like.
I was a willing accomplice in my own fate. It was fantastic. It was such a great movie.
The reason why I knew about this film is because my friend sent me an interview with Michelle Yeoh, because me and my friend Sarah, who we've had on the podcast, she was on the Chinese New Year episode. We both think of Michelle Yeoh as our auntie. We are like, she is Hokkien. I am Hokkien. Michelle Yeoh comes from Ippo, which is like right on the corner from where my family come from. Michelle Yeoh's accent is the exact same accent of my mother, where it's like kind of Chinese, but kind of British, and easily slips into various Chinese dialects.
Could you explain what Hokkien is?
Hokkien is, it's a type of Chinese. So you have like Han Chinese, you have Hakka Chinese. I am specifically Hokkien. A couple hundred years ago, the people from the Fujian province in China left China and moved to the Malaysian Peninsula. So that is like Malaysia and Singapore. So that whole island area. So if you are of Chinese descent from Fujian province, but your family's been in Malaysia for a long enough time, you're not Chinese like Han anymore, you're Hokkien. And that's what I am. And I believe that's what Michelle Yeoh is. And therefore, she is Auntie Michelle. So when I first heard about this film, I heard her talking about this film. And I heard her saying that this was the role she's been waiting for.
Mm-hmm.
It was a role that allowed her to show what she could do. From martial arts perspective, from a dramatic acting perspective, from a comedy perspective. And also, this is her first film in Hollywood where she is the main character. normally in a Hollywood film, she's the side character, she's the auntie, she's the mother, she's not the grandmother, she refuses to do those roles. But it's the first film where she's like the main lead actor on the film. And it's so cool to see someone I grew up watching being so successful in Hong Kong cinema be as successful in Hollywood cinema. And so I was like, die hard, we're going to support this film. And I've seen it in cinemas 3 times, and I will pay to see it streaming. It comes out streaming, I think, this week. So listeners of this podcast can definitely get access to this film, even if it's not being played at cinemas near you.
Where will it stream?
It's on Amazon. It's on Google Play. I saw it at a bunch of different places. Like, there's, if you Google Everything, Everywhere, All at Once streaming, you will definitely find it. I will pay that money. I will give so much money to this film. I want the directors, the producers, everyone to know that this film should be a box office success so they do more films like this.
Yes, it should. And it is amazing. Such a great movie.
I got 4 kind of things I want to talk about, but I'm also willing, because I know you also saw this film and love this film, maybe there's other things that you want to jump in on as well. But there are a couple things that I feel like really need to be talked about when we think about Everything Everywhere All at Once. The first one is Ki Hui Kwan, who plays Waymond. Mm-hmm. He is the sweetest, loveliest person in the world. You will recognize him from Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom and The Goonies. He was in a bunch of movies in the 80s as a child star.
Oh, he was Short Round in Indiana Jones too.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes.
Holy shit.
So he was working in the movie industry as an actor in the 80s as a child actor. And then after he started those 2 films, his phone kind of stopped ringing. So he noticed a lot of his co-stars, a lot of his peers were still getting auditions, were still getting work as actors. And he kind of felt like there isn't space for me. Right? And that he didn't have the opportunity to be on camera anymore. This is a moment in which the white supremacist systems of Hollywood are not offering the same opportunities to an Asian American actor as they are to a white actor. But Ki Hui Kwan is an awesome human person. He loved making movies. So just because his phone stopped ringing, that did not stop him. He went to film school, learned how to make films, and started working behind the scenes, and including working for Wong Kar-wai as an assistant director and even doing work as a stunt coordinator.
Whoa.
This guy was like, fine, you're not going to call me? You guys are like kind of racist? Okay, fuck you. I'm going to do this because I love this. And so for 20 years, he was working behind the scenes. And then an amazing film called Crazy Rich Asians came out. Have you seen Crazy Rich Asians?
I have. I love that movie.
It's like a classic, sappy, slightly shitty rom-com, but only Asian people. And I love that. I love that. I feel like we should get our own shitty rom-coms.
I think true representation is when you don't just get representation in the good stuff, but also in the bad stuff.
Exactly.
In the crappy. Yeah, there was just an article about gay representation in Danish media.
Ooh.
Because now there's the first gay couple on Married at First Sight.
Oh, wow.
Have you heard about that show? Yeah, exactly.
Oh, no.
that is just the shittiest possible concept for a reality TV show, is two strangers getting married at first sight. Yeah. But now we have representation. That's a good thing, I guess.
Yeah, I feel like every minority should have their kind of crap rom-com that's like very predictable. But hey, we all get to have one. I feel like we all should get to have one.
Exactly.
Anyways. He saw Crazy Rich Asians and he had FOMO. He had the fear of missing out. There is now finally space for people like me in Hollywood. And I wasn't even in the audition. I wasn't even in the running for any of these parts. So he called up one of his friends who was a manager and was like, hey, do you want to be my manager? Do you want to be my agent? Do you want to help me out? And the first audition he walked into was this one. And he got the part.
That's amazing.
And he did such a great job.
Also, when I saw him, I was like, is that Jackie Chan? Is that a digitally de-aged Jackie Chan? Because he's obviously younger than Jackie Chan. But there's some of the same sweetness, some of the same humor.
Yeah.
Some of the same like niceness about him.
Yeah.
And definitely some of the same haircuts.
Yeah, he definitely has like a very old school Jackie Chan haircut in this film. It's fantastic. And also the fanny pack fight scene. That was a very Jackie Chan inspired fight scene.
Yes.
Like it was comedic. It had all like the kind of like timing beats that a Jackie Chan fight would have.
Fighting with unusual weapons instead of with knives and guns or whatever.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So in the film itself, there are three different versions of Wayman. There's our timeline Wayman, we have CEO Wayman, and we have Alpha Wayman. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that he talks about in the behind the scenes of this film is how he got the characterization for all three of them. Because there is a moment in the film where you just see the top of his face, and you only see his eyes, and you can tell when he goes from Alpha Wayman back to our Wayman. The ability of this man to deliver a performance is so impressive. He worked with a physical movement coach. And what they did is they like went through the script and distilled each of the Waymans into an animal. So, for example, our timeline Wayman is a squirrel. Mm-hmm. He's like kind of frightened and skittering around, and he's like easily startled. Mm-hmm. CEO Wayman, who is very sly and slick and cool, is a fox. Mm-hmm. And Alpha Wayman, who's like swooping in at danger and like coming at it, is an eagle. And so this movement coach had him actually being a squirrel, like eating like a squirrel, crawling on the floor like a squirrel, like really embodying a squirrel. And then from there, built the character off of that animal characterization, wow, which I found hilarious.
That is hilarious. Two questions.
Yes.
First of all, Wayman, is that a Chinese name somebody would pick for themselves? Or, I mean, it's not Raymond, it's Wayman.
Yes. There is an actor called Wayman Lee who was an uncredited movie producer on this. And I'm pretty sure that it's a reference to him.
Got it.
That's my assumption.
Got it. And other question, this actor, could he fight already? Or did he have to learn for the movie? Because he's amazing in it.
So yes, he already knew how to do martial arts. He's been a stunt coordinator and a stuntman previously, but the particular style of fighting using the fanny pack has a specific name, which I've forgotten, of course. He did not know that style of fighting. So like all of his martial arts background is just like, yeah, we see that you can do all of these things, but we can see you cannot do this thing. So we're going to do this thing. And you're going to have to learn how to do it.
And it worked because that scene is amazing and had very, very strong Jackie Chan vibes. There's a specific scene in Drunken Master 2 where Jackie Chan fights with a dish towel.
Yes.
A tea towel. It reminded me a lot about this fanny pack fight, which is hilarious and amazing and so well choreographed.
Yes.
Beautiful. Beautiful.
All the fights are incredibly well choreographed. The stunt coordinators on this project were Brian and Andy Lee from Martial Club. They actually run a YouTube channel and do really cool content online for free for everyone, showing you how to do stunts, like basic moves, fitness stuff, and also adorably behind the scenes videos from Everything Everywhere All at Once. And also one of them was also in Shang-Chi as well. So they're doing very well for themselves. They started on YouTube, but now they're like starring in all of like the big Asian blockbuster films.
That's amazing.
So I will make sure to put a link to their YouTube channel and their behind the scenes video in the show notes because that's well worth checking out.
Yes.
The next thing I wanted to talk about was the visuals.
Oh, man.
In three words, can you describe what this film looked like to you?
It looked like Everything Everywhere All at Once. No, it takes place across various alternate universes, timelines, right? Mm-hmm. But part of the movie takes place in the most mundane settings.
Yeah.
We open in their apartment over their laundromat.
Yeah.
Then we go to the tax office, and that's where some of the fight scenes take place. So there is that contrast between the most mundane settings you can imagine and then the most outlandish visuals and costumes and makeup. And that contrast works so well, especially because the first 15 minutes of the movie is just Chinese family drama.
Yeah, pretty much.
Nothing weird going on. And then the movie makes a hard turn. And I was like, what the? And that was amazing. That contrast in the visuals, I think, worked so well. Mm. And it heightened the weird stuff.
Yes.
Got even weirder because it was contrasted against the mundane visuals of like the tax office, gray and beige cubicles and Jamie Lee Curtis in full civil servant gear.
Yeah.
It was amazing. Yeah.
Her character of Deirdre, I did not recognize her until the credits. Like, I did not know it was her.
You told me it was her. I would never have guessed, not in a million years.
So one of the things I really love about the film is the use of color. Uh-huh. Throughout the film, there are very clear color stories happening. There's a really bright color palette throughout the film. And the way in which the Daniels, who are the directors, composed every frame Like, every still shot of this film is beautiful. And there's so many little details and everything. Another visual motif we see throughout the film is circles. You have the circle of the everything bagel. You have the circle of the googly eyes. They're in a laundromat. So they're constantly surrounded by these dark black circles, these voids into the darkness. True. I don't think it's a coincidence that they were in a laundromat. When the IRS agent Deirdre circles the karaoke slip, circles it aggressively, making a very big black circle slash bagel. Like, the use of visual imagery, like the first time we see the family, we see them reflected in a round mirror, a circular mirror.
That's right, we do.
If you go back and watch the film, which I recommend doing at least three times, you will see that the circle motif comes up again. Another circle image that just came into my head is the ball gag. Or when they first walk into the district manager's office, there is a statue that's circular.
Yeah.
It's a very strong visual motif that holds the whole film together, regardless of which universe they are in, regardless of which reality they're in. This circular theme keeps coming back. And I think because it's such a scattered film in terms of like the places and the realities it takes place in, having that visual unity, having that consistent thread, holding it all together, I think is such a beautiful way of making it feel cohesive, despite the fact it's very weird.
It's very, very weird in the best possible way.
Yes.
I can see that. And I had not noticed the circles. I will be rewatching this movie and I will be looking out for all of the circles when I do.
Yeah. I think I noticed it on the third watch. Took me until then to figure it out.
Yeah.
Another aspect of the visual elements of the film is Jobu Tabaki. I can't not talk about Jobu Tabaki because the outfits and the makeup that Jobu got to wear on set are just incredible. It's high fashion. It's drag. It's beautiful. It's sparkles. It's glitter. It's such a fun exploration of if somebody had access to the infinite universes and could see everything all the time, they would go mental and they would just wear whatever the fuck they wanted. It was so cool to see Stephanie, the actor playing Jobu, really pull off some really extravagant looks.
Yes.
Like, she is a tiny, tiny, tiny girl, and these looks were huge. But she, because she carried herself with such, I mean, Jobu was a very powerful villain.
Mm-hmm.
She carried herself in such a way that she wasn't ever dwarfed by these looks.
Nope.
But my God, the fashion. Iconic. Truly iconic.
And then, again, contrast, because one of the outfits is just golf wear.
Yeah.
It's like a skirt, a polo shirt.
Yes.
And a golf club, and then that little visor thing they wear. And nothing extreme. And then I think the next one is like completely out there.
I mean, she goes from wearing the wrestling outfit with the blue stripe across her face to the golf outfit.
Yeah, so again, contrast. I think it's something they play with a lot in this movie.
Yeah.
Going from one extreme to the other.
Another element of the visuals that's really interesting is the way in which the main character, Evelyn, played by Michelle Yeoh, travels through universes. She often is being pulled backwards through the world.
Such a cool effect.
Which is a very cool effect. And all of the B-roll that you see in the background flashing past her. So one of the Daniels who directed the film, Daniel Kwan, apparently just had like a small camera and just walked around New York and filmed everything for like a year. So this film has been in the making for like, I think, a decade. And since they thought of the idea and they thought of having that as a transition, Daniel Kwan, one of the directors, was just walking around getting B-roll.
I love that.
The commitment. The commitment.
The commitment. Seriously.
So good.
Yeah.
Speaking of Daniels, the directing duo behind this film are Daniel Scheinhardt and Daniel Kwan. And something that I really appreciate about their directing is that they fucking love movies. They just love movies. And I think you can feel that in the film itself. It is an homage to cinema, including references to The Matrix, 2001 Space Odyssey, Jackie Chan, In the Mood for Love. There's a whole scene that's basically just In the Mood for Love, but shorter. I think there's Stephen Chow references here in the way in which some of the comedy, particularly the muscle pinky fingers, that's awesome. So Stephen Chow. Kung Fu Panda with the almond cookies. And of course. Ratatouille.
Raccoonie. That was hilarious.
That was so well done.
The alternate universe in which Pixar made a movie with a raccoon controlling a chef instead of a rat. Yeah, raccoonie. So, So funny. Yeah.
My favorite thing about that scene, there's a moment in the scene for those of you, I mean, everyone listening out should have seen the film. So yes. The Rakakuni scene where Evelyn is trying to express to her family about, you guys were like Rakakuni. And she's quite clearly in this moment mispronouncing Ratatouille. And I have had that exact same conversation with my mother about a word where like, no, you're saying it wrong. And her just being like, no, it's this. And like the defiance in Michelle Yeoh's voice when she delivered that dialogue sequence. Oh my God. This is like sushi and shushi all over again. And yeah, then to have it come true and there actually to be a Rakakuni was like, oh man, I'm wrong. Michelle Yeoh is right. Of course she's right.
The Daniels also wrote it? Or they direct? Yes, they also wrote it. Yeah. So they clearly know that family dynamic and they know that. Yeah.
Annoyingly, they do. Awesome. In interviews, they talked about every time they pitched for something like a music video, whatever, and it was rejected, they wouldn't throw away that idea. They'd keep it in their back pocket. They also blamed Rihanna. So I feel like they pitched for Rihanna videos a couple times and she kept saying no. For those of you who've seen Turn Down for What, that music video was directed by the Daniels.
Oh, that explains why that's so awesome.
And you'll also recognize the main dancer in that music video is also in Everything Everywhere All at Once.
No way.
She's the Indian dancer on the screen and eventually has hot dogs for fingers.
Oh, that's amazing. Okay, if anybody has not seen that music video, we're putting the video in the show notes as well. And there's a making of video. They return to it 10 years later and they talk to some of the people behind it.
Oh, I want to watch that. I haven't seen that.
So for instance, there's this elderly woman with huge boobs. And at one point her boobs are like independently going up and down to the music. And I was like, does she have pectoral muscle control like Terry Crews? And she does not. There's somebody behind her jiggling her boobs.
Oh my God.
You can learn a lot about that. It was made on basically no budget. Knowing that if you rewatch the video, you can actually see somebody behind her jiggling her boobs.
Oh my God, that's hilarious.
We're going to link to both of those. It is one of the most iconic music videos in history. It's so good.
And also bearing in mind that they made that music video, which has like sentient boobs and penises dancing to the music. Mm-hmm. It makes a lot of the humor and a lot of the jokes and Everything Everywhere All at Once make sense. Like the whole butt plug fight scene makes so much more sense now.
Yes.
I'm just like, yes, this is your humor. I get it. I understand where you're coming from now. This makes sense to me.
Because this movie it's so dumb and it's so smart.
Oh,
at the same time, there's the sort of fight scene where some people are fighting to insert a butt plug in themselves or keep it away from the others.
Yes.
But the movie also has real heart and something to say. That contrast, I think, is phenomenal.
It is a movie of contrast, as you pointed out. But as they're writing the movie and coming up with the concepts and they're figuring out, okay, we had this idea for hot dog fingers. We're going to put that here. We had this idea for this. They realize that they were in trouble because Rick and Morty had just started airing.
Mm-hmm.
And the Spider-Man Homecoming, the Spider-Man No Way Home started coming out. Which one's? The multi-universe Spider-Man movie. I don't know which one it was called. The latest Spider-Man one.
The latest one, yeah.
Yeah. Marvel. It's all the same.
Yeah.
And so they were getting quite worried that like their film was going to lose its sparkle, its like unique take, because there's so many other multiverse narratives out there right now. But I am of the very strong opinion, and I'm hoping you agree with me, that this is the multiverse movie.
It certainly brings something to the table that none of the others do. Mm-hmm. And it has a unique take on it because you don't actually travel between the alternate universe. It's a really interesting concept. It's such a cool way of introducing it that you can pull in somebody's skills from an alternate version of you by doing weird things like eating a chapstick or inserting a butt plug if that's what it takes, or paper cuts between every finger. It brings a new way of doing multiverses that I think is really interesting.
Yeah.
But then more than that, it brings something that none of the others brought, which is just sheer energy. This movie is like, it's 110 octane all the way through the movie. It's fantastic. But it also brings a depth that you don't get in Spider-Man Home, whatever, which is fine. I enjoyed it. There was nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
But it didn't hit me the way this movie hit me. It didn't have as much to say about deeper subjects while being even more entertaining. I was way more entertained by Everything than I was by Spider-Man Home something something.
You are doing such a great job of setting me up for my segues. I have not told you what I'm going to talk about, and yet you're setting me up beautifully for everything I want to talk about.
Awesome.
Speaking of the deeper meanings of the film.
Yes.
Let's talk about bagels and googly eyes. So this film really explores the tension between nihilism and existentialism. Mm-hmm. I would say they are represented in the film by the everything bagel, which is nihilism, and the googly eyes, which is existentialism. I use these words casually, nihilism, existentialism. Do you have an understanding? Can you explain them to our audience?
Let me see if I get this one. Nihilism is nothing matters. You might as well just sit down and do nothing because nothing ever matters anyway. That's nihilism, right?
Yes. Yeah, pretty much.
And then existentialism is, well, it's nothing matters. It's essentially the same basic premise. Nothing matters. So we have to make our own meaning.
Yes. Yes. Right? Perfect. Yeah. Amazing. In this film, we have two, obviously, circles representing these two concepts. So we have the everything bagel that Jobu makes. Mm-hmm. And I will get you to read out a quote from Jobu.
So that Jobu says, "I got bored one day, then I put everything in a bagel. Everything. All my hopes and dreams, my old report cards, every breed of dog, every personal ad on Craigslist, sesame, poppy seed, salt, and it collapsed in on itself. Because you see, when you really put everything on a bagel, it becomes this, the truth." Then Evelyn says, "What is the truth?" And Jobu answers, "Nothing matters."
This is Jobu Tsubaki's approach to the world. It's the everything bagel. Nothing matters. Nothing is real. Nothing is important. And she uses the everything bagel. Major spoilers here. If you haven't seen the film, seriously, go away.
Yeah.
And she uses this bagel as a form of self-destruction.
Because she has been everywhere and seen everything. Something happened to her mind that made her experience everything everywhere all at once. And it basically broke her.
Yes.
And once you've done that, you know, what is the point of anything?
Because she saw everything. She saw that nothing is important. Nothing matters. And so her response to the nothingness of the world is self-destruction, mm-hmm. is lie down, give up. And actually, Evelyn has this response as well. Earlier on in the film, when Wayman comes to her with like the task of being Alpha Wayman, blah, blah. "Do you want to just sit here with your consequences, or do you want to come with me and save the universe?" Mm-hmm. And she says, "No, I want to lie down." And she just lies down on the ground. So Jobu Tsubaki and the Everything Bagel is a very nihilistic approach to the lack of meaning in this world versus the googly eyes.
Googly eyes.
The googly eyes is an approach called existentialism, which, as you said, it is, there is no meaning in this world. You need to acknowledge the absurdity of existence, but know that you can discover meaning on an individual level. And this is where Wayman comes into things. So Wayman is representing the googly eyes. And in my head, it's these two philosophical concepts represented by these various circles and these various characters fighting over Evelyn. Mm-hmm. Evelyn, at the beginning of this film, has nihilistic tendencies. She has mm-hmm. tendencies to lie down and give up. But by the end of the film, she's accepted this idea of creating her own meaning. Reality doesn't make sense. But at the same time, there is space for you to create your own meaning and purpose. And I think this is one of the things that we talked about after we watched the film. We both adore that at the end of the day, radical kindness and absurdism saves the day. It's not violence, but it's empathy and love. Or as Wayman put it,
"The only thing I do know is that we have to be kind. Please be kind, especially when we don't know what's going on." Yes. Yes. And it's interesting to notice the shift in the movie where the first many action set pieces are fights.
Yeah.
And then they become more about keeping people away from something instead of defeating them.
Yeah.
And then it devolves into not fighting at all.
Yeah.
That's a fantastic journey that that movie takes.
And I think that that shift is really characterized by which Wayman are we experiencing.
Ah.
Alpha Wayman is kind of a dick. He's yeah. like jumping into universes trying to find an Evelyn that can save the world and disposing of them when they're proving to not be useful to him versus Squirrel Wayman, who is just trying to find love and be loved. That's all he wants. He sees that the world is a mess and he's just trying to approach it with radical kindness and create a world for himself that he can experience, that he's happy to live in, right? Mm-hmm. He's just trying to find love and happiness. That's all that man is trying to do. And so after Alpha Wayman dies, and we have more of our universe Wayman, Squirrel Wayman, we see that shift really dramatically happen.
Yeah. Yeah. Interestingly, what, in your opinion, what broke Evelyn? Because she had hopes, she had dreams, she wanted a better world and a better life for herself. What broke her, do you think?
Well, one of the things that Michelle Yeoh said about this film is that it's an homage to the ordinary woman, right? The character she's playing isn't a movie star. She isn't a celebrity. She isn't an opera singer. She is the average woman. Mm-hmm. Somebody that Michelle Yeoh said you would walk right past on the street and wouldn't even look at her twice.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was an element of the mundanity of her life, where everything she tried, she failed. Everything she wanted for and coped for, she failed. Even like the marriage, right? She wanted Wayman. She ran away with him. She chose him over her family and ran away to the States. And it failed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was the consistent failure and the consistent kind of like grinding down of the world that pushed her down. We also see a lot of intergenerational trauma happening in this film. Her father essentially disowns her for running away. And then that familial fracture is kind of like carried on with her relationship with her daughter Joy and her not being able to communicate with her, not being able to understand how to talk to her. I think that is compounded by the fact that they are immigrant family. And I think this is very much part of the family drama side of the story. Like, I think that element is what broke Evelyn and what like made her want to just accept nihilism and lie down. But she has someone in her life who really loves her and cares for her and believes in radical kindness and therefore was saved by love, which is so cute and so lovely. And it sounds so cheesy, but it really isn't cheesy in the film.
No, it absolutely totally works. You're rooting for these characters in the middle of all of these absurd things going on. I deeply cared about what happened to each and every one of them.
Yeah.
Especially Wayman, because the squirrel Wayman, because he was just trying to be nice and make the best of things.
Yeah. He's genuinely the absolute fucking best. I love Squirrel Wayman.
And at the end of the day, this does make the movie Hope Punk, I think, right?
It definitely does. Yes, yeah. 100%. I think this is a Hope Punk film.
Yeah.
On the basis that the underlying message that you walk away from the film is like a happy crying. Mm-hmm. At least that's how I always felt at the end of the film.
Yeah.
But also the fact that the message is be kind.
Yes.
And that was delivered with such sincerity that it's the message you walk away with at the end of the day.
Yeah. No, that was fantastic. Speaking of existentialism, have you seen Bedazzled with Brendan Fraser and Liz Hurley?
The devil that we makes a deal with the devil?
Exactly.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So many years ago now.
Okay. That movie also touches on existentialism. Here's a little dialogue sequence I'd like you to read from that movie. Okay. Brendan Fraser's character is Elliot Richards, and then his love interest, Alison Gardner, and there he's a famous writer. Here he is.
Elliot Richards. Well, I was just trying to make a simple point, really. Every time I've reread Camus and Sartre, I kept thinking to myself, why does the existential dilemma have to be so damned bleak? Alison Gardner. Yes. Elliot. Yes, we're alone in the universe. Yes, life is meaningless. Death is inevitable. But is that necessarily so depressing? Allison, I couldn't agree more. Don't you think secular humanism is yummy? Oh, delish. That's totally what this film is arguing as well, though.
Yeah, right? And I think that is the dilemma we're all facing. Alternative is to believe in some externally defined meaning, like God wants you to do this, that is the purpose of your life.
Yeah.
Or, you know, this guru says that this is the purpose of life and you live according to that. I think that could possibly be nice. I think a lot of people live great lives having that externally defined for them. There are also some pitfalls. People also do terrible things in the names of those externally defined meanings of life. But if you don't have that, and a lot of people these days don't, there is no guru telling me what the purpose of life is. There is no religious text or figure or pope or bishop telling me how to live my life or what to value. And yes, I am going to die. We all are. We talked about that in a previous episode.
Yep.
Given that, how do you find meaning in life? And I think this movie has some very good answers. You know, be kind. I don't think nihilism is a terribly convincing solution. I wouldn't want to go that way.
No.
But I do think that secular humanism, be kind, value other people, try to make the world a little bit better with the things you do, with the ways you treat other people.
Yeah.
I think that is the meaning of life. You know, create a world that's a little bit better than if you hadn't been in it.
Yeah.
And go easy on yourself when you don't, because we don't always do that. We constantly screw up and do things that hurt other people. That's fine too. But just try to be better. I think secular humanism is delish. I agree.
So yummy.
So yummy.
That was a beautiful, beautiful end to our conversation about nihilism and existentialism.
Yes.
So now
yes.
I'm going to do a quick shotgun trivia moment. I'm going to give you some like little bits and pieces.
Hit me.
The working title for this film was called A Woman Tries to Do Her Taxes.
I think they went with a better title.
The protagonist role was originally written for Mr. Jackie Chan. However,
no way.
The directors thought it would be more interesting if the relationship divorce breakdown dynamic was from a woman's perspective,
mm-hmm.
rewrote the film, and then realized, shit, it has to be Michelle Yeoh. It can only be Michelle Yeoh. We better hope she wants to do this film.
I could not. There is nobody else, right?
There's nobody else. During the making of this film, Daniel Kwan, one of the directors, thought it'd be very interesting to have the protagonist have undiagnosed ADHD.
Uh-huh.
And in the process of researching undiagnosed ADHD in adults, realized that he had undiagnosed ADHD as an adult.
That's amazing.
Both directors have cameos in the movie.
Uh-huh.
So Daniel Kwan has smaller cameos. He was one of the muggers who tries to beat up Eleanor that ends up her learning kung fu.
Mm-hmm.
And he's also in the final fight scene. He's one of the first people to get sucked into the bagel.
Mm-hmm.
Daniel Scheinhardt is more impressively in the movie as the BDSM manager. And he's also in the 2001 Space Odyssey sequence, the ape with the hot dog fingers that beats up the human with normal hands. That ape is played by one of the directors.
That's hilarious. Yeah.
There is a little Easter egg in the film where in the moment where Evelyn uses her super muscular pinky to smash a guard into the ground, there is a sound effect that's almost identical to the Super Smash Brothers fight sounds in the video game. It is not the exact sound because of copyright reasons, but it is like the closest sound to like they could have legally.
And not get sued, yeah.
And that moment is Daniel Kwan's personal favorite Easter egg of the film.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And finally, for a film with a lot of special effects, they did rely very heavily on just supporting practical effects. So there was a lot of wire work. There's a lot of smash cuts where they just took out one element and put something else in. Like the exploding heads were like quick cuts. But there was only 6 people on the VFX team.
That's insane.
Tiny VFX team. And most of the VFX was done at home in quarantine. It was done in people's houses on their home computers, mostly through Zoom.
Wow. That's amazing. Because that can be 100 people or hundreds of people on a...
For a Marvel film, they would have multiple studios working on it. They would have like at least 2 or 3 visual effects houses
yeah.
with a full company of people working for them.
Yeah.
So and to have 6 people is insane.
And I want to say the effects totally work.
Yes.
Given how insane the visuals are and how unusual the worlds they present are, there is no point where the effects break down and you're like, that looks fake.
Yeah, no.
Does not happen fucking once.
No.
That happens in Marvel movies all the time, by the way, but not in this one. Everything doesn't look real because it's obviously not, but it looks believable every single step of the way, and that's amazing.
I think the use of practical effects with VFX support makes everything feel very tangible.
Mm-hmm.
Like the hot dog fingers, for example, they could have been CGI, but instead what they did is they cast a mold of the actress's hands
mm-hmm.
and then use that to build them silicone gloves that fit their hands perfectly, which then allowed them to have dexterity through their hot dog fingers.
Got it.
Which is such a weird sentence that I said out loud.
Yeah. So Katie, why this movie? Except, of course, for the fact that it's amazing.
So this film is about immigrants and intergenerational trauma and taxes.
Yeah.
It just happens to be told through 258 universes and like 27 different film genres and far too many hot dog fingers.
Yeah.
But at its core, it's a film about a Malay Chinese immigrant trying to accept her queer daughter in the only way she understands how to.
Mm-hmm.
As a queer immigrant woman with a Chinese Malay mother, I have never... ever in my life seen myself on screen. Not like
wow.
this.
Wow.
The family dynamic portrayed in this film is so close to my own that it makes my heart ache. I've seen it in cinemas 3 times, and each and every time, I have laughed out loud, I have cheered, I have fully broken down into sobs. I am so lucky to have this film be so representative of my life and be an actually amazing film.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that it has like the squishy marshmallow ending to boot, mm-hmm. like it celebrates radical kindness and empathy in a way that I aspire to. If anyone who had anything to do with making this film ever hears this, from the bottom of my hope punk Chinese queer heart, thank you so much for making this. This wonderful, weird, intensely bizarre film is a soothing balm, and it is my all-time favorite film, and I don't think anything will ever be able to top it. This film is so me in the sense that it's my story, but also that it's so fucking weird and that it's also so sweet and so kind. And I just, I want to talk about this film always, forever. Everywhere, all at once.
I see what you did there. I can see that, and I can absolutely understand why that movie hits you the way it does. Mm-hmm. And it is amazing. I have a reflection on the movie, and I think I mentioned this when you were in Copenhagen, that I think the closest parallel in a movie that's come out recently is Mad Max Fury Road.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, radically different movies, radically different subject matters, but they have something in common, which is both of them work, and they shouldn't.
Yeah.
Both of them are too weird or too extreme or too just bizarre to work. But I think the reason they work is that they are both movies that turn all of the dials to 11. Mm. The visuals, the sound, the music, the bizarre things that go on stage, the world that we are in or the worlds that we're in, all of that is taken to 11. If any element of that had not been extreme, had not been exaggerated, had not been heightened, I think all of the other heightened things would have failed.
Mm.
But given that the colors and the visuals, the music and everything just goes to 11, I think that makes it work. But in both cases, it is anchored by some acting performances that are absolutely real and human and believable. There's nothing in here that's overacted.
No.
There's nothing in here that is too much, that goes into parody. As you see in a lot of action movies, right? The villain will be so exaggerated that it completely goes into parody.
Mm.
There is none of that in Everything Everywhere All at Once. Everything they do or their choices are anchored in their personality. You know, it's so well acted that you buy it. I bought it. That makes both of these movies work. And I watched the Mad Max Fury Road 20 times. I look forward to watching Everything Everywhere All at Once 20 times.
Yay.
And catching all the Easter eggs.
There's so much this time.
Yes.
I also think it is 100%. An example of millennial fantasy is what mm-hmm. I've started calling this genre of film, in which you see intergenerational trauma being resolved through the adult parent making amends with the child.
Mm-hmm.
So you see it in things like Encanto, Turning Red, Everything Everywhere All at Once. All of these films are what I'm calling millennial fantasy because they are written by millennials for millennials, and it's a fantasy because it's never fucking going to happen for us.
That got dark.
This is the fantasy I want. I want my mom to apologize, and I know it's never going to happen. So instead, I'm going to watch Everything Everywhere All at Once and a little speech at the end that Evelyn gives to Joy and like live vicariously.
Yeah, I can see that. I can
hilarious.
See that.
But anyway, that is Everything Everywhere All at Once. By the time this podcast comes out, I'm pretty sure it will definitely be available wherever you are. I do recommend seeing it in cinemas though.
Oh yeah.
If you have that option. This is a visual treat. There is so much happening on that screen that you want to go see it in a cinema. There's also so many moments in the film where you feel connected to the people in the room with you. Like the rock sequence. When all sound cuts out and you're just staring at subtitles on a screen and everyone is giggling. It's just that moment of silence and like reverence in that room. Incidentally, originally they were going to have the actors voice over that uh-huh. moment. And Michelle Yeoh encouraged the directors to just do subtitles, which I think was like, go, if you're going to do it, guys, lean in, go for it.
Brilliant.
Make it a weird silent moment.
Also, those rocks, they're round.
They are round.
There you go.
I also have them as my desktop screensaver right now. Yes. Go watch the film.
Go watch the film.
If you've already watched the film, go see it again.
Rewatch it. Yeah, several times.
In the show notes, I'll put some of my favorite behind-the-scenes cast interviews and bits and pieces. Also, I'm not a big fan of Wisecrack, but they did do an episode on the philosophy behind Everything Everywhere All at Once, looking at the nihilism versus existentialism battle. So I'll link that as well.
And in the meantime, we're just waiting for the Cinema Wins episode on Everything Everywhere All at Once. He's going to lose his mind.
How are they going to, like, how? It's just like everything is a win.
Exactly.
So, my dear listener, what did you think about Everything Everywhere All at Once? Do you have any questions, or did we leave out something awesome about Everything Everywhere All at Once? Go to our website or Instagram at Electric Enthusiasm and leave us a comment telling us, what do you think about Everything Everywhere All at Once? I also like saying the name of the film. I really do. It's a mouthful, but I'm here for it.
It is the greatest movie title ever, in my opinion.
Such a great movie title.
Yeah.
It also gives absolutely nothing away whilst being so deeply about this movie.
Yes.
So
perfect.
Good.
Perfect, like everything else in the movie.
Ha! I just saw what's in the script for next. I have a lot of photos like this.
Yeah, I would imagine you do. Because in this episode's Moment of Meta, I want to talk about cheering others on. And what prompted this particular topic is a picture from the recent Copenhagen Lindy Exchange, a swing dance festival held in Copenhagen a couple of weeks ago. And a couple of local dancers, Pia and Namiko, two wonderful dancers, are on the stage dancing. And you're next to them. Post the picture in our script. Katie, could you describe your pose? You're in the background. You're not dancing. You're in the audience. And what are you doing?
So I am part of the audience, the jam circle, watching these dancers. I am kneeling low enough so people behind me can see, except that my energy is exclusively up. Like, I have one arm in the air, my mouth is open, I'm clearly screaming and cheering these guys on.
Yes, and I happen to know that's something you do a lot.
It is.
Yeah, and that's the topic I chose, is cheering others on. And swing dancing is definitely an area that lets you do that a lot. Mm-hmm. Somebody might be performing and they're doing awesome stuff, but you could also be dancing with somebody and they do something awesome and you cheer them on. But I think there are so many chances in life to cheer other people on in whatever it is they're doing.
Yeah.
And I don't think we do that enough. I think a lot of the time people are like, yeah, that was awesome. And then we don't tell somebody.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. How do you approach this topic?
Something that happens a lot in our society is that we will, like, acknowledge the good work, maybe tell someone, like, oh, did you know that Alex did this great thing? They'll tell that other person, we won't freaking tell you. And so I'm a big believer in closing that communication gap. Yeah. For example, if someone told me, hey, I really love Alex's shirts collection, his shirts are incredible, I'm very quickly going to go to you and be like, hey, Alex, guess what? Your name came up because you have an incredible shirt collection, and me and blah, 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 we're just talking about how fabulous they are.
This one is brand new.
It's very nice.
Thank you.
But, like, I feel like as people, we're really bad at telling ourselves we're good enough. We're really bad at acknowledging the good in our lives. And if, as another person in our community, as another person in this world, if I can help you see the good in you, if I can help just shine a light on something that you might not have realized is something exceptionally shiny, I'm going to do it. And I'm going to do it enthusiastically and loudly.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I think that's a huge life skill. And there are some areas, some venues where it's perfectly normal. Like if you go to a sports event of some kind. Mm-hmm. And your team does something cool, you're not going to sit there and go, yeah, you know what, that was pretty good. You are going to cheer.
Yeah.
Unless you're at a golf game, then you're going to do the
golf clap.
But golf sucks anyway. Not a real sport. And I will die on that hill. If you go to a concert, I was just at a concert with Nathaniel Rateliff and the Night Sweats.
Mm-hmm.
And
That's a great band name.
Yes. And they launch into their most famous song, Son of a Bitch. And the audience went bananas. It was so cool. And of course, that energy feeds the band. That energy comes back to the audience. It's a feedback loop, right? So there are absolutely venues where this is perfectly normal, expected, and people just do it. But there are also venues where we don't. And I think we should do it way more. And that enthusiastic cheering on when you do something cool, I think, has a lot of potential for creating a little bit of a better day for people. I think I mentioned before that I do this thing called CrossFit.
actually, Alec, you don't do CrossFit.
Damn
you're,
it. Should,
you don't do CrossFit because I your should, gym is not a CrossFit gym anymore.
I you should never have told you that.
Unbranded workout.
I do a star brand CrossFit. Mom, can we have CrossFit? No, we have CrossFit at home. CrossFit Copenhagen a few years ago decided not to be a CrossFit gym. It's the same workouts, but it's not technically not CrossFit anymore. You're correct. It is a little bit of a sore point.
You should never have told me that.
Exactly. I do this thing called CrossFit-ish. Anyway, when I see somebody doing a cool lift or working really hard, I will cheer them on. I will go, that was amazing. It's actually a thing in most CrossFit-ish gyms. That if you're done with your workout and somebody else is still working, you go there and you cheer them on. Aww. Let's give them the energy to finish their workout. I think the more you can do that, I think the better. If we could all just be on the lookout for people around us doing awesome stuff and then just cheer them on while they're doing it, I think that would be amazing. Specifically, we did this with I may have mentioned it before, with the Copenhagen Ironman race, where we got 20 people together. And we went and stood on the marathon, the final marathon they have to do. And we identified the runners who were really tired. And we cheered them on by name. We would post a lookout earlier on the route to look up their numbers. That guy looks really tired. That lady looks really beat. Yeah. Look up their name and text it to the group who were a little further ahead on the track. And then we could cheer that person on by name. Go, Peter, go. It was amazing. Cheering people on is something we can all do. Mm-hmm. I think it requires two things. You need to be on the lookout for people doing awesome things, and then you need to have the courage to actually be loud about it.
Yeah.
To actually say something and go, yeah, that was amazing. Maybe not just that was pretty good, but yeah, that was amazing.
Do you have any advice on how to build up that courage? I think people can see the good. I think people just don't have the courage to make it loud.
Yeah. I think two things can help. Practice, try it and see what happens.
Yeah.
That's one area. And the other thing that can help is to think about times where somebody has done this for you and think about what did it do for you. And I'm willing to bet it was pretty awesome, actually. And then have the realization that if you did that to somebody else, it might be really awesome for them. Yeah. And also cheering gives you energy, right? I mean,
100%.
Yeah. In that pic, you don't look beat. You don't look tired. It was a long night of dancing.
Yeah, it was.
So I think that's amazing. It's one of the things I admire about you is specifically in dancing but also in general, when you see something awesome going on, you're not afraid to say so and you're not afraid to cheer loudly and energetically. And I think that's fantastic.
That's one of my superpowers is that I will cheer for you. Like an entire squad of cheerleaders is living inside of me.
Yeah. You told me that the first time you saw Everything Everywhere All at Once, you were cheering in the cinema.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And then I got told off for it.
Well, that was in England, right?
It was.
Yeah, yeah.
There's some things I really do like about the UK, but like the sense that you can't have emotions kind of annoys me.
Especially positive emotions, right?
Yeah. I am too much for the UK in a lot of ways. I just found it really funny. I was right after the fanny pack fight scene. I clapped and cheered. Mm-hmm. And then she's like, could you please stop that? And do you know what the first thought that ran through my head was? Enthusiasm at number one, don't yuck someone's yum.
Yes.
You need to listen to Electric Enthusiasm. Calm down.
Exactly. And I do think that's probably the final benefit of cheering other people on is that the people who don't like it, you can annoy them. and that is amazing in itself.
Always, always good to have the little spiteful motivations.
Spite-thusiasm.
Enthusiasm.
Yeah.
Fabulous.
So that was our moment of meta. Go cheer other people on loudly and enthusiastically. You love it. They'll love it. It'll make the world a little bit better. Mm-hmm. We do have a little bit of a roundup from a previous episode.
What do we got?
Because we made everything bagels while you were here.
That is true.
And they were delicious.
But is that a previous episode? That's the current episode.
That's the current. Technically, you're correct. We have a roundup from this episode. Everything bagels are awesome, and we made some, and they were delicious.
Yep.
Yeah.
I love it. So we hope you enjoyed sharing some of our enthusiasms in this episode. Please visit our website, electricenthusiasm.com, or find us on Instagram at electricenthusiasm to discover more episodes or to leave a comment.
And now, dear listener, be thankful that you don't live in the alternate universe where you have hot dog fingers.
That's a good one.
That's a good one. Yeah. Unless you're into that kind of thing. Yeah. Who am I to yuck your hot dog? Yum.